Hello, hello, Vancouver babes. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Welcome to Babe Waves, the intersectional feminist show brought to you by the Gender Empowerment Collective. We are broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hankamina-speaking Musqueam people. I am Hayone, and I am joined today in the studio with Camille and Anna.
Hi!
Today we have a really interesting interview that Camille did earlier today with Julia, I guess. She's from Spain. She's the founder of So I Had an Abortion. So before we start talking about it and playing the interview, we just want to acknowledge the fact that this subject may be difficult to some of our audience, so you might want to tune back with us in an hour. So here's Julia interview with Camille.
Hi, I'm Camille, and today I'm interviewing Julia, who started So I Had an Abortion. And I'm here to ask her a couple of questions. But first of all, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm stoked.
And so it's like I know that you started So I Had an Abortion as a woman who has experienced abortion. Mm-hmm. And so would you like to share your experience with us?
Sure. My experience with abortion is a highly privileged one. I want to preface it by saying that. I know that very many people have a difficult time with their experiences, but I thankfully had two rather seamless abortions. The context for my having abortions was actually that I was convinced for the longest time that I could not have children. So early last year, I went to a fertility clinic to find out whether I could in fact have children, not because I was endeavoring to get pregnant, but because I wanted to save future me the devastation of when I'm trying to have children to find out that I can't. Turns out that's not a thing you can do, so it was a waste of my time. And by the end of the summer, I had had two abortions. Both of my abortions were medical abortions, in which basically you go to the clinic and you see three different service providers, including a doctor, a counselor, and a pharmacist. And you get a shot in your arm that stops the fetal growth. And then you go home with misoprostol, which are these like hexagonal-shaped pills that you need to insert into your vagina every like 6 to 8 hours or something like that throughout a day. And that makes your body miscarry. So the first time I found out I was pregnant, I was rather surprised, not only because I was convinced I couldn't make babies, but because it's a surprising thing. Also, the entire procedure was super seamless, and I had anticipated that it was going to be one of the hardest days of my life, because that's all you really hear about abortions. You either don't hear anything about abortions, or you hear a catastrophized narrative usually put out there by anti-abortionists. So thankfully, I had a friend who a week previous had just gone through the same thing, so she walked me through it, and I think that really helped me with my my experience at the time. The second abortion was a little bit more difficult because the abortion didn't take, so I had to do two rounds of the misoprostol. And then I actually met my little embryo on the toilet one day. So that was a little bit shocking. But I just decided to honor what my body had tried to put together, and I buried it with my apple tree with the intention to be the best mother I can be sometime in the future, whenever I'm ready.
Thanks a lot for such an honest sharing. So when did you start that program? Mm. And what does it do? And
okay, yeah, kind of give
what's
you
the shape of it.
Yes. Give you the what.
Yes.
So after my first abortion, actually during the time that I was actively aborting, I was at home because my partner travels a lot and I was by myself. And so I invited a friend over and was talking to her about it very candidly, very innocuously, as I have done. And she expressed gratitude to me for having been so candid. And that kind of got my wheels turning. I kind of started thinking about, you know, why that is. But I put it on the back burner. And then after my second abortion, I was just angry because my first abortion, I felt totally fine about it. I told all of my people about it, you know? And then the second one I told no one about because I had this overwhelming sense of guilt and shame, you know, being a 27-year-old woman who, you know, typically by societal standards is at a point in their lives that could take on being a parent or starting a family or what have you. And who should definitely know better about preventing pregnancy after having just terminated one a few months previous. So I was at first ashamed and felt a lot of guilt, and then that kind of morphed into just anger and resentment towards a society and a culture that would make me feel that way about myself. And so during the course of the subsequent months, I started thinking about what I could possibly do. I started thinking about, well, maybe I could write my own story, but do I want it to end there? And so by the time January rolled around, I decided I wanted to start this storytelling platform because I believe that people's minds change through exposure. And so my reasoning is if we put as many abortion stories out there and expose people to the multitude of experiences and truths in those stories, that the narrative, the public discourse around abortion will shift from one that's imbued in stigma and fear and often misinformation, if you're looking at anti-abortionists, and shift it towards one that's accepting, you know, something, you know, that it's a very normal thing. Depending on where you live in North America, 1 in 3 or 1 in 5 women will have one abortion in their life. You know, that's unfortunately doesn't capture non-binary or trans identifying individuals. So if anybody actually has that information from a credible source, I would really like them to contact me. But basically, I just decided that we needed to talk about it. Because if public perception of what abortion is and what it means and how it happens changes, it could have a massive sociocultural impact. It could even get to a point where it has some political will, and that ideally, with more and more people talking about it, it'll become this thing that's just like any other subject to revolving healthcare, and there will be some reform in so far as abortion access and provision.
So talking about the health access, I would like to expand on that a little bit. Mm-hmm. So what do you know is the health access for abortion? Abortion services in Canada as of today, and even, or maybe just Vancouver.
Yeah, Canada's a massive country.
It's a massive country,
because it's all kind of federal,
right?
But in Vancouver, actually, it wasn't until just over a year ago that medical abortions were readily available. There's only a few clinics, actually. I think, that I know of in the Lower Mainland, there's one clinic that gives medical abortions. Medical abortions are prior to, I believe, the 8-week mark. I wouldn't quote me on that. It's been some time since I brushed up on this. And then after that, you would have to have an aspirational abortion. And then after that, if you have any pregnancy complications, then it would have to be a surgical abortion. Surgical abortions are provided for sure at BC Women's Hospital, and aspirational abortions are available at most women's clinics. So as of probably a year and a bit ago, Vancouver does have readily available in terms of, you know, there's spaces that provide them abortion care. Unfortunately, you know, if you live rurally, that's another hurdle for you to jump through. If you don't have medical coverage like MSP, then you have to pay for it outright, and it's something like $400 for the procedure. If you do have MSP, then I think it's $100 for the procedure. So it's all, it's accessible, but it's not accessible. It's accessible in the sense that it exists. It's not accessible in the sense that there aren't really any supports in place for people who are of low socioeconomic status, live rurally, etc. The nice thing, though, is that a lot of the clinics that do offer abortion services and care are these beautifully judgment-free zones. And so any person is able to go and access one. Oftentimes they do tend to have interpreters on staff and what have you for people who don't speak English very well. And the whole process of it is meant to be harm reduction focused, in the sense that you do have to see a counselor, and the counselor does have to evaluate whether you do in fact want to have this abortion and whether you're making the decision based on what you want or under duress. So,
so you explained that actually having two different abortions and two different experiences around the day of. Could you expand on that a little bit? Like, what were the emotions and thoughts that you went through having to find out?
The second abortion was the more challenging one for me. The first one, I felt like I was very well supported because my friend had given me the rundown, and I felt very secure in my decision. My partner was very supportive. The second one was a bit more of a mindfuck, in the sense that, you know, I got pregnant again, and I was like, well, there's always this part in your brain that kind of goes off, the emotional part that's very non-rational, that goes off like an alarm bell being like, maybe you're getting pregnant for a reason, maybe you should have babies now, you know? Or afterwards, when the abortion didn't take, I was like, well, maybe I was supposed to have this baby. I can't now because I've had the shot in my arm and the fetal growth has stopped. But, you know, like, your emotional brain goes kind of a little bit out of control. And it's really hard to disentangle what it is that you want from what society expects from you. So you don't really know. It's hard to differentiate between your own motivations and what is motivating you externally to make decisions. So that was rather challenging. I think that's why when I did see it come out, I wanted to honor it. Because I really have been always a very maternal person. I've always imagined that I would have children. I've always envisioned a life where I would have children. I volunteer with children. I have always enjoyed their presence and their lessons and their energy. But I recognize that it would be unfair for me to bring someone into this world being completely unprepared to do so. Not unfair to myself, really. I mean, sure, it would be unfair to myself in certain regards. It might limit me in certain regards, but I think that once you have a child, you don't care about those things, really. It becomes far less selfless. So really, for me, it was more about that potential child. You know, it's about protecting them from a subpar life with a mother who's hurrying to get through a grad program. I would have a newborn right now. I would have a couple month old. You know, I'd be having to go through my grad studies. I'd be, you know, working on a student salary, trying to make ends meet with a partner who works at a job that takes them out of town for weeks on end. So it just would be completely inappropriate and would not be the best life that I could offer that child. So that was really my main motivation. And I can't really apologize for that.
Yeah, please don't. I want to come back to, you said something really interesting on how you believe that the exposure of stories for abortions makes it more, just would change minds because mm-hmm. of the exposure. And I feel that around abortion, like the contrast is about something that is so like external, like forces, external like influences of like what society wants you to do. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you are making a decision that is overall extremely intimate mm-hmm. and extremely personal. And how do you feel that you realized there was a duality of it? Were you aware of it before as a woman going through the world? Or did you kind of like stumble upon it as you experienced those abortions?
I think that in everything in life, you can be an empath in your life, you know, someone who's very empathetic and believe that you can know what something is going to be like based on what you have heard other people's experiences to be. And I had always thought that if I was in the situation that I would need to have an abortion, that it would be a difficult decision. Just because of that combat between rational brain and emotional brain and greater society and motivations. So, but what I was completely caught off guard with was, you know, how readily I wanted to tell people about it. I was caught off guard by that because I really, really thought that most people kept it quiet. And I think I have to thank my friend who had debriefed me on the whole, this is what getting a medical abortion is like previous to my first one, for opening me up to that as an option. And the thing is that like once I started talking about it, I found out that so many of my friends have had abortions. And it's some of my like closest friends that I've known for decades. And it made me feel disappointed and sad about how things are in the world at this point, that women can't overtly tell their stories and express bodily autonomy. It's deeply disconcerting, actually, that that's still something that's so heavily policed. And I mean, abortion is healthcare. It should be readily available to all for whatever reasons they have, because everybody has different reasons and no reason is less legitimate than another. So that's definitely what opened my eyes to it, was my own experience with telling my story, how cathartic it is, how you can claim your story so shamelessly and really come to terms with the experience, reconcile it into your own sense of self in a way that is self-serving and truthful and authentic. And in the same way, open up the space for other people to do the same thing.
So what was it like for you to find out that all those close friends that had come through the same thing, and without you being aware of it and finally sharing it, What was your reaction to that?
You know, I think I was slightly shocked, of course, because I've known them for so long, and I would have liked for them to have felt comfortable to talk to me about it. At the same time, I recognize that everybody's experience is really intimate, and sometimes it can take years for you to assimilate that experience with your own self, a sense of self, because they can be really trying times. So I in no way felt like they had not included me, you know, because they eventually did. And also, it's inappropriate for anyone to force someone to tell them their abortion story. So I was just kind of like, I'm happy that you're telling me now. And if you ever want to tell your story in any way beyond just telling me, feel free to. And I hope that you're sharing your story with other people as well, not just me. Mm-hmm. Because even on the day-to-day, you know, on a micro level, it can have an impact. It's just my hopes and dreams extrapolating to have it have a macro impact where it would shift the way that society views it and what have you.
Did you feel like when you shared your first abortion experience, did you experience certain stigmas in like people's reactions?
Mm. No, I can't really say that I did, because the people that I did tell about it were people that are very close to me, and the experience of itself being at the clinic. Like I said, was very seamless. They know what they're doing. And because they honestly, like the clinic that I went to, I asked how many slots they have for medical abortions a day. And they have up to 10. So that means that there are up to 10 medical abortions going on at one clinic in Vancouver every day, possibly on average, let's say, max. So it's something that they are very well acquainted with and very prepared to take on any type of manifestation of emotions, that like they run the gambit. So I've been very fortunate. I've been very fortunate in the sense that, you know, I was able to afford my abortion. I am very fortunate in the sense that it wasn't horribly painful. Like the list of side effects they give you is so terrifying for when you're going, they're like, here you go, here's a list of horrible things that might happen to you. Here's a list of contacts in case these horrible things might happen to you. They do equip you with a bunch of different painkillers. And then they just kind of usher you home after you feel ready that you can go. And I was very lucky that I didn't experience anything like what the listed effects would be. So, and then I had a ton of support. So I've been very fortunate. I've been very fortunate. And I realized that in my telling of my story, it is not inclusive of all the other stories that are out there, and it shouldn't be taken as demonstrative of what an abortion experience is. It's just one of the many different types of experiences that happen.
I want to ask like maybe a too personal question. You will tell me.
Sure.
Because I'm interested into how it felt like to go back to your like love life and your mm. just meeting people and having the same partner or a different partner, mm-hmm. and what did you notice in you? Did it feel like it changed?
Well, I'm still with the same partner, so that will probably completely skew the answer to this question. I mean, the partner that I'm currently with, I see a future with this person. I see all the future, you know? I don't really see him going anywhere. So that's also something that kind of compounded the emotional difficulty around making my decisions for terminating both those pregnancies, because it's like, well, I'm with this person that I foresee myself doing this with in the future. Why not do it now? But like I said, I had my reasons not to. And our life hasn't significantly changed since then. We still hold each other in high regard, and we still know that we're going to be together and that that's an option for us in the future. In fact, I think after my first one, because I was previously convinced I couldn't have children, one of the things that we were thankful for was that if we wanted to in the future, we could make babies. So, bit of a silver lining. And then meeting other people, I guess in a non-romantic sense, I don't really readily disclose that I've had an abortion to strangers, but because of my platform, depending on the social environment, I will disclose it. Actually, scrap that. I actually usually disclose it because I'm at the point now where I want to push the boundaries, and I sometimes don't really care if people feel uncomfortable. Because I do believe that it's for a greater purpose. You know, I'm not about to push my... I'm not about to, like, push my opinions or agenda on anybody, because my platform is meant to be very inclusive, and that's inclusive of opinions regarding abortion as well, you know, as long as they're not horrible opinions where people are saying terrible things. I'm very much open to them. I see them as learning opportunities for myself as well as for them. If we can keep the lines of communication open, then it's more likely that at some point they might change opinion. I'm just planting little seeds, you know. I'm not trying to be aggressive about it, but hopefully it's enough of an impact on a micro level that might influence people. So I do bring it up quite readily, but I don't often disclose that I myself have had an abortion.
That was Julia, interviewed by Camille. And we are going to... There is a second part to this amazing interview, but we are going to take a little break and play a couple of ads before coming back to play the second part. Stay tuned.
That is a sigh of relief, because Fun Drive 2017 is officially over. To everyone who donated their time, energy, money, forgot to donate now but will donate online at citr.ca, couldn't donate this year but will donate in the future, and to our community as a whole, CITR and Discorder want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just like thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for trusting us with your money, and we promise to make good use of it.
Muchas gracias. Gracias, gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Merci, genre infiniment.
Thank you, everybody. That was great.
It's time to put away your textbooks and get your summer shades out, because the Sociology Students Association is having their annual year-end barbecue. On Thursday, April 6th at 1 p.m., join us in the ANZO Building Courtyard for food and fun times. Come relax and flip some burgers with us as we celebrate the end of classes with friends and faculty alike. All are welcome to attend.
Well, I'm tired of this dirty old city, and I'm tired of too much.
Back at CITR 101.9 FM. This is Babe Waves, and I'm Hayone here in the studio with Anna and Camille. And we are back with an interview Camille did earlier today with Julia, the founder of So I Had an Abortion. Before we play, we want to acknowledge that this is a difficult subject for some of our audience, so you might want to tune back in half an hour. So yeah, let's just listen to the second part of the interview.
Did you experience any difference of attitudes in people's reactions to your experience across the gender spectrum?
That's interesting. Interesting question. Honestly, cisgendered men tend to shy away from it completely because consider it cisgender men. They tend to shy away from it completely because they don't feel like they're about to tell a woman, you know, what to do, or that they're being judgmental or anything like that. I feel like a lot of times they're just trying to cover their asses by not saying anything, but that's okay. Within non-binary communities and like LGBTQ plus communities, within which I have quite a few friends, it's very much the same kind of expression of worry that I get from cisgendered women. That's kind of like, oh my God, are you okay? And I appreciate that, but it also is slightly frustrating to me that the knee-jerk reaction to my disclosing that I've had abortions is, oh my God, are you okay? Because it's just an example of how society skews our perceptions of what abortion is and how catastrophized it is in certain regards to, like, oh my God, if you've had an abortion, it's been like the most traumatizing thing ever, which for some people it absolutely is. But it's frustrating to me that something that should be basic level health care can be regarded as something that's so catastrophic, so life-altering, so, which again, caveat or what have you, like, not just because that wasn't my experience doesn't mean that that isn't the experience that a lot of people do have. But I think more to the point, it's frustrating that it's not a normalized thing that people are able to exercise their bodily autonomy and go out and terminate a pregnancy if they so wish. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I'm nodding on air. Nobody can see that. No, it's really interesting what you said, that actually it is a trauma because people talk about it as a trauma. People talk about it as a as a pivotal moment and experience. And if we had a different narrative around it, it might be a different experience altogether.
Exactly. Imagine if I disclosed it and someone was like, oh my God, me too. What was your experience like? Or, oh my God, you had an abortion. I know some people who have had abortions. Or, oh, what was that like? You know, still ask what it was like or relate to it on some level or in some way or inquire about it. Be inquisitive. Get inquisitive. Why not? You know, some people just want to talk about it. Some people don't. But the fact that the knee-jerk reaction is, oh, my God, are you okay, is unnerving a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and doesn't, makes you feel like a stigmatized, like more
fully
stigmatized, where it actually, you mentioned that, like, you had the stats, like, in
yep.
mind, way better than me. like, a lot of women, like, go mm-hmm. through at least one abortion through their life. So it is part of life. It is, like, mm-hmm. a miscarriage is also part of life.
Yeah.
And it's, it shouldn't, just unveiling the taboo around it
mm-hmm.
might, it's still an important day in your life,
yeah.
but it doesn't have to be a defining moment.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be something that's dampened by societally imposed fear and stigma. You know, it can be like any other procedure, you know? Surgery is fucking scary, you know? Like, but it's treated like a medical procedure because it is one. And same with abortion, you know? And I think that also part of the reason why people don't really talk about abortions or miscarrying or pregnancy complications at that is because people don't really talk about pregnancy candidly. It's very much a romanticized thing. And of course it is because, you know, people who are able to have children should want to have children because that's what you're meant to do. So to propagate the human existence. So I think that it's a huge issue. It's really expansive. There's tons of things going on. But most specifically with abortion, I think that if we were just to start talking about it, it could radically change things. And I'm not the only person who started a platform like this. There's so many other ones, which on my Instagram account, I try to make a point of drawing people's attention to these existing resources, such as exhale.org, which coined the term pro-voice to motivate people to tell their stories about exercising their bodily autonomy. There's Shout Your Abortion out of New York City, which is doing some really cool things. Their main statement is abortion is freedom. There's the 1 in 3 campaign. There's Sea Change. And a lot of even local organizations have testimonial pages where people can talk about their experiences. So I'm by no means starting something new. I just hope that I can contribute to motivating people to talk about it and just claim their stories, be shameless about it.
It's great to hear you give a shout out to different platforms like that. And it kind of leads me to my next question, which is how, in an ideal world, what would reproductive health services look like for you? What's your picture?
That's a very big question because it's multi-level. You have to start with inclusive sexual education. And by inclusive, I mean including people who are not heteronormative, who do not ascribe to gender binaries. and be realistic about it. And, you know, people have always had sex. People will continue to have sex. You can't really stop people from having sex. The only thing you can do is ensure that they're doing it safely. And if they don't want to get pregnant, that they're taking the proper precautions not to get pregnant. So that would be the first level. The second level would be availability of contraception and affordability of contraception, because that's a massive thing. If you're a person with a uterus, you run the risk of getting pregnant. And the onus is on you societally to figure out how to make sure not to get pregnant. In reality, there should be a lot of supports in place to ensure that people are accessing contraception. But because it is such a sinkhole of money for some people, it's not a feasible thing to do. So then you're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place where it's like, well, I want to have sex. I don't want to get pregnant. What do I do? So that would be the second level. And then the third level is when contraception fails and you end up pregnant or with an STI. And then you have multiple different subsidiaries to each of those, you know, because like if you get pregnant, then you choose whether to keep it or not. And then there, like if you decide that you don't want to keep it, then there's medical abortion if you catch it in time, or there's aspirational abortion if you catch it a little late. Or you can keep it, and then that's maternal care. If you get an STI, then you need to go for screening. You need to get treatment. If it's a chronic thing, then you need to make sure that you have the proper treatment and supports in place to manage your chronic ailment. It's a complicated thing. It's got so many different levels to it. It just, ideally, we would get to a point in which sexual education is inclusive, contraception is widely available and affordable, and that goes beyond just main cities. Abortion care is health care, and so it's readily available in urban centers as well as rural cities. And STI prevention and care is readily available. The frustrating thing is, insofar as like abortion, the one thing that always just drives me bonkers is that forcing people to have children makes absolutely no sense, especially socioeconomically. It makes no sense to introduce new people into the world, to have people struggle economically to raise this new human being, and then to have this new little human being put stress economically onto the system. And because that little human being is being raised by one that wasn't prepared for them, they're going to struggle as well. So it's just this self-perpetuating problem. And it's really oppressive. And that's my main issue with it is that. So I'm hoping that by getting people talking about it, it would have enough of a reach and an impact that it would normalize the conversation about it. And therefore, people wouldn't be getting or feeling judged for taking control of their own lives. Because you're allowed to fuck up, you know? You should be allowed to make mistakes and do whatever you can to rectify the situation.
What I'm really hearing here, which I really love, it's I really hear choice and empowerment. Mm-hmm. And so would you like to expand on that?
Sure. I mean, I'm all about that. I think that with today's socio-cultural and political climate, it's both frustrating and enlightening to see how much people are jumping on like the intersectional feminism bandwagon. I think that that's just fantastic. I really see intersectional feminism as kind of this like mothership for social change, because it's inclusive. And I really think that for there to be any change in the world, we need to lead with love, and love is inclusive, not divisive. We need to find the things that we can see in one another that can drive one another forward. We need to be open to learning from one another and get called out by one another, and not take that as an affront, but as a claiming of space. We're all entitled to the pie. Just because one person is asking to be included doesn't mean that you're giving up your slice. So I think intersectional feminism has really framed my platform. And I think that it's a hopeful vehicle for change.
Coming back to your story, just before the interview, when mm-hmm. we were setting up, you were telling us that you come from Spain, actually.
I do.
And so do you think your abortion experience would have been drastically different if you have had it in Spain?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The socio-historical context in Spain is completely different than it is in Canada. And also Vancouver is far more liberal than other places in Canada. So it's nice that I found myself here during that time. But Spain was under fascist rule until into the 80s, and was during that time highly, highly Catholic. And I mean, it still is, less so, but during the fascist regime, it was kind of an instated thing, to the point where art books where artists had nudes were painted over to censor nudity in schools and stuff like that. We're years down the line, but you can't really separate policy and healthcare and those types of things from like socio-cultural context and socio-historical type of context. So in Spain, it would have been very different. I visit Spain every year to see my family, and I see my group of friends while I'm there. And my experience with contraception is very different. My experience with getting pap smears is completely different. My perceived availability of those resources is that I can access them, and that I can access them whenever I want, and that it's sometimes a nerve-wracking thing, but I can do it. Whereas in Spain, it's very different. A lot of my friends were into their 20s before they got their first pap smear. It's very different. Also culturally, within the family unit, it would have been dealt with very differently, I think, as well, because Well, because it's such a new democracy, and even though the healthcare system is very good in Spain, it's one of the leading healthcare systems in the world, it's a cultural thing. It's a cultural thing. And with the economic decline in Spain and everything, there's also been a social shift that's like kind of gearing towards going back towards fascism in a really scary way, because people are feeling uncertain. So it definitely would not have been the same kind of experience at all. I think it would have been far more difficult to access. I think I would have been far less supported. I think that my decision maybe would have been completely different as well if I didn't perceive the accessibility that I perceived to have here.
Yeah, just what you said just made me think of the French voice for feminism for a long time, Simone de Beauvoir, who mentioned that you should never forget that all it would take is a political, economic, or religious crisis for women's rights to be called into question.
Absolutely. It's what it's happening in the States right now.
Yes, it's very much into context. And so what are your thoughts around that? How are we going to block their way?
Well, see, that's the thing. I think that that's why feminism needs to be intersectional. It's because it needs to be inclusive. We need to hear each other out. We need to hear what our common goal is. We need to set priorities. We need to hear each other out. But we're not going to do it if we're divided. We need to recognize that each person's experience is very different from one another, but our collective experience is that we don't have the same opportunities as cisgendered men. And I think, and we're not, women, cisgendered women aren't the only people who are fighting for that right. Equality.
Right.
Equality. Equality should be for everybody, which is why I'm such a strong advocate of intersectional feminism, because it actually accounts for different identities and the intersections therein, because we're all different. We all have grown up in different contexts. We all have encountered different things. And I recognize that as like a cisgendered white woman, I have far less to speak to than, say, a twin-spirited indigenous woman, or say a queer black woman, or, you know, like, or a Southeast Asian trans woman. You know, I can't even begin to imagine their experiences, but we have to be open to listening to those experiences and learn from them and not get defensive when someone tells you that you're not including them. Because if they say so, then you're not. And you should learn to. Because we're not going to get anywhere by not considering one another's needs.
You told us a little bit before, but could you repeat for us how we can follow you?
Sure. So the website for So I Had an Abortion is soihadanabortion.squarespace.com. I'm a poor student, so I wasn't able to buy a domain. and then the bulk of my social media is on Instagram at So I Had an Abortion, all lowercase, no separation, all one word. And on Twitter, which I am still figuring out, is at So I Had an Abort. Because then I couldn't have more characters. So that's where I'm at. I'm most active on Instagram, and it's probably the best educational resource that I can offer. And then the website is the storytelling platform itself. People are able to submit stories in written, visual, audio, or video form. It's basically just based on how people feel that they can best capture their experience. So it's not limited to any certain medium. And
how many stories have you received and shared so far?
So I launched the website in February, and I now have, I think, 5 stories out, 5 to 6. And stories come out each Wednesday. Hashtag hump day, hashtag no bump day. So some people might think that that's really tasteless, but considering that it's a platform dedicated to celebrating abortion narratives, I think it's kind of apt.
It's a good pun. It's pretty good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story.
Thank you.
I'm very happy to have listened to all of that. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Julia speaking about her experience and her project, So I Had an Abortion. And here in the studio is Camille. She did the interview earlier today. So I wanted to ask you, what did you take out of it?
I really liked just the way she spoke about it. It was such an unapologetic and honest testimony. It was so refreshing to hear a woman like take power of her life and of herself. I really appreciate that. And also I liked how, like, her idea through the project, the idea is to expose stories to make it more of the norm, more available to people to know about it, and that way, and to know about it beforehand, that way when it happens to you, you actually feel that you've been exposed to it and you have an option, you have a choice. All For along sure. the way, you have choice. And I think that's like such an important defining moment in a human life, actually. It's like to know that we are not just biologically driven, that we have a choice over our life. We For can sure. shape it the way we want.
Yeah, and I really liked how she kept saying that she hasn't started anything new at all. This is something that has been going on for a long time, and a lot of people that are not privileged to, that don't have all of the privilege, right? They are able to start all of these discussions. So she hasn't started anything new, that she's just adding another voice into this tapestry of conversations around abortion. And I think it was very, really interesting. Everything, really, she said. She was great.
Yeah, she was. And even after, while we were in the recording room, afterwards she mentioned that there was actually like some interesting stats around LGBT and Q+ people community who actually are like 4 to 10 chances more likely to experience to have like a undesired pregnancy, which we thought was like such a
insane
number. And she was saying that actually it's because there is that societal norm and pressure. So there is very much something like a box that people feel that they want to fit in, instead of just like shaping the society and the box in what you want and what you need.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was refreshing to have that conversation. So thank you so much, Julia, for coming into the show, and thank you, Camille, for interviewing her. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, so we cannot have a longer discussion about this, but the podcast is going to be available at citr.ca/bavewaves. So thank you so much for tuning in. This is CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you, and see you next week.
Yep. Thank you.